Welcome to the Ideas Lab Predictor podcast from the University of Birmingham. In each edition, we hear from an expert in a different field who gives us insider information on key trends, upcoming events, and what they think the near future holds.
Hello, and today I'm with Dr. Kenneth Hamilton, who's Reader in Music at the University of Birmingham. And it's a special musical podcast today, something we haven't tried. So hi, Ken.
Hello, Lucy.
So could you tell us a little bit about your particular areas of expertise and interest?
Well, I mainly write about and research how one performs what one might call old music. And by old music, we mean effectively almost all the music we play in concert today, because we relatively rarely play modern music. So in my writings and my research, I try to investigate how was this music heard in the time it was composed. How did we hear Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin, Liszt, even Wagner? And was this different from the way we hear it today? And obviously, I wouldn't have a topic if the answer to this were not, yes, it was different.
I should point out that we're actually in a concert hall.
Yes, we're in the very lovely stage of the Barber Institute Concert Hall. In fact, I remember once doing a broadcast for Radio 3 from here where the presenter spent a long time talking about the colour of the piano and the polish and the case. But I fear the audience for this podcast will just have to take that as read.
So the first thing we're going to talk about is this improvisation around musical pieces in performance.
This has actually become, to some extent, a hot topic just over the last few years. I suspect the reason is we are desperately trying to find some way of making the classical concert experience new again. We've been playing the same pieces for about 200 years, and it's getting rather dull. And one of the things that seems to have excited a lot of people, and I don't just mean musicians, I mean actually audiences, is the realization that, in fact, in Mozart's day, in Beethoven's day, even in Liszt's day, well into the 19th century, concerts were far more like pop and jazz concerts, what we would think of as pop and jazz concerts. And pianists would improvise before pieces, after pieces, transitions between pieces. In other words, the concert could well turn into a sort of medley.
So I'm assuming you're prepared with some examples.
I always have examples. Anything that's called prelude from the 18th and early 19th century is effectively an example of improvised style prelude. And the most famous one is obviously the first Bach prelude from the 48 Preludes and Fugues, which of course begins like this. When I was a piano student, this piece used to puzzle me because I kept wondering, well, where does the tune come in? Of course, There is no tune. It just keeps strumming along. And this worried the later romantics as well because, you know, of course, Charles Gounod wrote a tune for it and the famous Bach Gounod Ave Maria. So he worried about it too and added this rather sentimental tune on top. But in fact, it's not meant to have a tune because it's simply a sort of short introduction of the sort that people improvise. In other words, it tests out the instrument, shuts the audience up, because the audience would be talking, and puts them, as Beethoven's pupil Czerny once said, in the mood for the music to follow. But the interesting thing is that many pieces of music were expected to have this sort of introduction. Now, it so happens that I've just given a Mozart concert about 15 minutes before we're recording this, and one of the pieces I was playing begins in the score like this, with a set of variations, and this is the theme. That is how people normally play it nowadays, more or less, and you start with the first note on the page. But in Mozart's day, you would never do that with a piece like that, a variation piece. You would play something at the beginning, as I say, to set the mood, to introduce the piece. So when I was playing this today, I improvised a short introduction that went more or less like this. That is a stylistically correct improvisation for the beginning of a piece like this. It's also designed as an interface, if you like, between performer and audience. For too long, the concert experience has been a museum-like thing where the performer is isolated from the audience, unlike popular music. But in fact, this was not the case at the time these pieces were composed. And perhaps we should think more of reintroducing some of these practices in modern-day performance.
So as audience, we feel like we should be sitting down, hushed, unresponsive, if you like, kind of an ossified inside, quiet backdrop to a performer.
People are terrified now. It's like dining in a restaurant where you don't know which cutlery you're supposed to use. And people are genuinely put off by this. They don't know when to clap. They don't know whether they're supposed to show any obvious signs of enjoyment.
What should we do?
Well, you should applaud. Let me put it this way. Any variation that you liked in Mozart's State, you would applaud.
So it's a bit more X Factor.
Exactly. I'm afraid, I'm sorry, it's exactly like that. And not only that, performers got very disappointed and embarrassed if nobody applauded in the middle of things. There was one particular variation in Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata that apparently was so often encored that if you didn't get an encore, it showed that you had a disaster in the performance. You hadn't played it very well. So we have the opposite effect nowadays. We expect total attention and silence and this rather glacial response from the audience. But I'm afraid this is not what was intended to be.
And it wasn't just the audience response or reaction that was different, but the instruments were different as well.
Especially in the 18th century, the instruments were radically different, and especially the piano, which, as Beethoven said, was in its infancy in those days. Beethoven, oddly enough, was not a fan of early instruments, despite what early instrument enthusiasts say nowadays, I'm afraid. But it so happens in this concert hall, because I've just given a Mozart concert, we also have a 40 piano imitation from around 1781, a Stein imitation. Now, I must admit that there are better 40 pianos around. This isn't a very good one.
It does look quite a bit wobbly.
Yes, it wasn't the wobbliness of the case that worried me so much as the wobbliness of the sound, but yes, you're right, they're both wobbly. Anyway, if I played the same opening of that variation set, the theme, I should say, as we heard in the Steinway Model D we heard a minute or two ago, then you could hear just a radically different sound world. As we can hear, it's slightly out of tune, and that isn't the 40 piano's fault, but we can actually hear a much, much quieter sound, effectively, a much quicker attack. In other words, it's maybe near a harpsichord than a Steinway. In other words, when I put a note down like this, I get a ping immediately rather than this sound blooming out. So it's very good, Mozart's piano, for short articulated phrases, and less good for longer cantabile phrases, which basically have to be divided up in Mozart's piano. But the issue really isn't how the differences work, which is an issue for performers, really. The issue is that this produces a different musical rhetoric. In other words, the music just sounds different. We're in a different musical world with an instrument like this. The really interesting thing about this is we're sort of embarrassed in some contexts by these early instruments these days. I was telling the audience earlier on about a film called Immortal Beloved, a quite recent film about Beethoven, where Gary Oldman, who plays Beethoven, leans down, because he's increasingly deaf, leans down towards the piano, desperately trying to hear what he's playing. And of course, the piano that we see on film, and it's beautifully done, is a genuine piano of Beethoven's day. But the sounds we actually hear are a modern Steinway concert grand. In other words, we like the look of these things, but we often don't want to hear how they sound.
So at this point in the podcast, I normally ask my guest what's coming up on their horizons over the next 18 months, 2 years or so in their field. So what's coming up in your world?
Well, what has just come up, of course, in 2010 is the Chopin centenary, when we've all been frantically running around playing Chopin, which is wonderful, but we're probably going to get very fed up with it soon. And the next thing we're going to get fed up with is the Liszt centenary in 2011. It's 200 years from the birth of Franz Liszt.
So whenabouts in 2011 is this happening?
Well, actually, Liszt was born on October the 22nd, but I suspect we'll be getting Liszt all over the year. There will be a sort of large-scale Liszt celebration event in the Purcell Room in London on the South Bank Centre on October the 15th, a Liszt forum involving my good self and many other concert pianists and Liszt scholars. So that will be an entire Liszt day. So anybody,
it will be a Liszt fest.
A Liszt fest, yes, a mini Liszt fest. So anybody that isn't completely so out-listed should come along and sort of immerse themselves in what's left of Liszt.
So we look forward to that. And Ken Hamilton, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
This podcast and others in the series are available on the Ideas Lab website, www.ideaslabuk.com. On the website, you can find out how to email us with comments, questions, or suggestions for future topics for the podcast. There's also information on the free support Ideas Lab has to offer to TV and radio producers, new media producers, and journalists. The interviewer for the Ideas Lab Predictor podcast was Lucy Vernal, and the producer was Andy Tutel.